Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And while Hal Bryan continues to be away on special assignment, I'm your other co-host, Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And I am thrilled to introduce a very special guest who played not one but two roles in Captain America, the First Avenger, and we'll be asking him about both of them. He's an actor and writer, has performed for stage, TV, and screen, both before and since Captain America. And I was surprised to learn that although he's credited as an English actor, and he sounds like an English actor, he was born in New York. So please welcome to the show a man whose name we've mentioned many, many times in past episodes, Leander Deeney.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. This is Leander Deeney. Yes. Hello.
Awesome. Thank you for being here. Jim, tell us about this minute of the movie.
Okay. I can't do Hal justice, but I'll do my best on minute 104. Here we go. In the cavernous cockpit. Let me try this again. In the cavernous cockpit of the Valkyrie, Steve Rogers and the Red Skull trade brutal punches. Steve locks the Red Skull in a headlock, but the Red Skull rolls him onto the glowing Tesseract reactor, forcing Steve to lose his grip. Grabbing his vibranium shield, Steve swings a haymaker, but the Red Skull seizes the shield, slamming it into Steve's chest. Steve retaliates with a fierce headbutt, snatching the shield back and hurling the Red Skull against the aircraft's controls. The Valkyrie lurches into a steep dive, throwing both men into weightlessness. They flail, struggling to fight in zero gravity as the plane plummets toward the ocean. Tumbling apart, the Red Skull grabs a structural girder, clawing his way to the control panel. He flips the autopilot switch, stabilizing the craft but sending Steve crashing into a catwalk. The Red Skull draws his futuristic pistol and walks towards Steve. I apologize to Hal for writing these things so floridly and I having to pronounce all those big $10 words. I apologize. But anyway, Leander, thank you so much for being on the show. We always have a great time with actors who've appeared in this film, and you've been one that we've been trying to have as a get for so long. So thank you very much.
No, not at all. Thank you for having me. It's nice to be able to revisit it. It's been a long time, and I've really enjoyed listening to the episodes of the podcast that I've been listening to before this. Thank you for having
Thanks
me.
So much. So to not keep our listeners in suspense any longer, Leander is the body double for pre-transformation Steve Rogers. You were young, skinny Steve, and we'd love to talk to you about that. We've talked to some of the effects people who made that happen, but we'd love to hear your side of that story, how you got the job, and so forth. And you also played a bartender who served beverages to Captain America and the Howling Commandos later in the movie. So let's start with pre-transformation Steve. How did you get that job? And did you know what it was when you auditioned for it?
Yeah, so it's tricky talking about this job or remembering it or explaining it because it sounds like I'm describing a dream. And I mean that in a kind of value neutral way, because sometimes I say it sounds like it was a nightmare, but I don't mean that it was bad. It was a good experience. It just was very similar to the narrative structure of an experience where you have someone else's face. You kind of wander around wearing somebody else's face and watching them from the shadows as they do things. So I auditioned in London. I'm a UK based actor. Obviously, it filmed here a lot. I'm sure you've covered that. Auditioned through Priscilla John. I cannot remember the scene. In my memory, it's a Bucky and Steve scene, but I know lots of other people auditioned with like placeholder scenes. So maybe I'm just remembering that wrong. So I had that in a London casting office and then went to Pinewood and had some green dots stuck on my face with a couple of other actors and was presented with some footage of Chris. I remember it being Chris. Again, this is quite a long time ago and none of the details feel like very real. They just feel like a ayahuasca trip. But I remember I remember Chris doing some quite simple movements of like moving from left and right, not trying to sort of do like a scene. And then we had to try and get the movements to match as quickly as possible. Even when I got the job, I didn't quite know what I'd signed up for. I'm basically a UK stage actor, so obviously extreme diets are not particularly a part of what I do. Firstly, they said obviously the guy can't get into the army. That's the whole point of the story. We've hired you because we can just about fit a CGI version of Chris's face onto your skull in a kind of efficient way. But you're small, so you are to Chris. They didn't say this, but I think it was like I am to Chris as a raisin is to a grape. A sort of tiny version of him. But it was obviously new and complicated, and I don't know if they knew quite what would be the best solution for the problem in any given shot. So when I rewatched the movie, I don't have any idea what I'm looking at any given moment. For all I know, the percentage of my body that's in there may be quite low, really. I always saw my job as being a human costume that is a bit more. I don't. I like the term body double. I try and feel proud of. Like I feel proud of. Like I don't want to. Because it's quite hard to put it, like a name to what I did, because the main task consisted of not distracting Chris whilst wearing his face and watching him from the shadows.
Before we push record, you mentioned
Sorry.
that you actually had some prosthetics. Was
I
that to make
did.
your face more closely resemble Chris's, or what's that?
Yeah, so I think the idea was to get it closer to the midpoint that they were trying to create. So I think in any given shot, they had an option to just shrink Chris down, or an option to use to hope that just with perspective and things, it's fine, or to put his face onto my head. And in that instance, I think they thought that there's an ear, one of my ears was a problem, and presumably is in the budget somewhere. That my lovely prosthetics artist, who's called John Moore, I looked this up, we're still in touch. He did Drax from
Oh,
Guardians of
wonderful.
the Galaxy afterwards. Yeah, he was lovely, and we'd start every day at 4 a.m. or whatever, and he'd, no, I'm exaggerating, 5 a.m., 5 a.m. And he would bring me courgettes he'd grown in his garden, and we listened to An American Werewolf in London whilst he applied this face. So I had a nice time. I think, however, and this is one of the ones where I'm a bit nervous about saying something that I'm not completely sure that I understood what was happening. I think maybe there was some miscommunication or a change of opinion about what the shape of my jaw was supposed to be like before they put Chris's head onto it. My understanding was that they were trying to get my jawline closer to his. And then by the time they did the CGI, they actually wanted to bring my jawline back to where it had originally been to make Chris look more like a 4F. Is that what they call it in the army? The 4F, yeah. So I met a CGI, I met a digital artist in Los Angeles when we did reshoots who'd been in the dark for months, removing this prosthetic from my face, pixel by pixel.
Oh
Which again, he may have been, I was in there for 5 minutes. He may have been joking, don't this, please don't drink this as gospel. But my understanding is that there was some distance in how much stuff was put on my face and how much stuff was supposed to be on my face.
Wow.
Or they end up, yeah.
Now, you said you had you were talking, I mean, I know they wanted you to be as scrawny as possible.
Yeah.
So were you put on an extreme diet to get out of shape for this, or?
Yeah, basically, yeah, to get in the worst shape possible. Occasionally, my trainer would tell me that I was running too fast and in danger of maybe developing some muscle mass. I don't know, honestly, I don't know that I really got quite small enough. I think even by the time, because I think a couple of, there were tests done with another performer and he was really very, very thin. I think they really wanted to see ribs. So I tried to give them as much rib cage as I could. But as I said, as a theatre actor, I'm not that used to dieting for work. I'm sure for people who do a lot of screen, it's a big part of the job now. So I did my I did a lot of running. Yeah, as Chris got bigger, I got smaller, typically.
I'm curious how or if you worked with Chris Evans and Joe Johnston to develop the character of pre-transformed Steve, because He has his own body language and his manner of standing and posture and sitting and walking is, and that's, I presume, mostly your body. What was that process like?
I think it's important to say that I never saw myself as having like a creative input on the interpretation of the character. I really like, I'm from an acting background and I do a lot of stage and physical stuff. I've done lots of kind of clowning and what they call physical theatre here, you know, mime. So I felt like that was what was helping me match what he was doing. But the way I understood my job, and Joe and Chris were both lovely. It was a very nice set to work on. I'm not just saying that. It was lovely and by far and away the biggest thing I've done, or like the most biggest, most intimidating set that I've been on. But they was terribly nice people to work with. And Joe was very relaxed about bringing me in and trying to get me to understand what they need to achieve. But my understanding of my job was that Chris was trying to start this character that, even from what he understood at that point, the franchise, who knew how long the franchise would be, like it was a major and I suppose intimidating for him undertaking, or an undertaking that he must have had like lots of thoughts about how do you start a character like that. I'm rambling a bit, but particularly Steve Rogers is kind of a Boy Scout. I mean, to be judgmental, but like Superman, he's a fundamentally decent guy. I think sometimes for an actor, it's n you the flaws can be a way of connecting with the audience or feeling like you understand the character. So playing someone who's such a good guy, I sort of remember reading it and feeling like I got that for Chris. That's quite that might have been quite a thing to undertake. So. Cut all of that. So while I was watching him, my job was to try and work out what he wanted from the scene, get my breathing as close to his as I could, and I don't think I got anywhere near, like, if I got 50% of a match on his breathing, I would see that as like I made a decent saving for them or like take time. But I didn't have long, you know. Chris would do the scene, I would try and not be too visible or too present. He would leave set. I would emerge from behind the curtain, and then Sebastian Stan or Stanley Tucci or Hayley Atwell, who I feel like I did most of my scenes with, at one point or another, Joe would have to say, "Okay, now here's a tiny little British man that you have to do the scene with." And take a few minutes for them to understand what was going on. And then what I wanted to do was give them something that was as close to what Chris had done, because a lot of the time there'll be some of them in that shot as well, or you know, if it's over Steve Rogers' shoulder. And whatever bit of me that was useful, I wanted to be as close as what Chris had done as possible. I really
Did
enjoyed watching it.
you get thrown around by Kieran O'Connor? We had Kieran on the show back earlier in the day, and you get to have a tussle with him. So I didn't, how many times he had to throw you into that garbage can?
And that was my happiest day on set. That was so
Oh,
grateful.
wonderful.
I really, by the end, I was like pretty much ready to ask the stunt team if I could join. Was I a member now? Because I like I said, I'm very small, so I think in my entire career I've only won one fictional fight. I basically mostly lose, so I feel like I should be able to take a fall. But it was a really great bin. You could really throw yourself into it. I don't know if it was some kind of rubber or. But it was lovely, and having the stunt, having people from the stunt department be like, "That was great. That was really, that was a really fun day. I had kind of a worst day. Sorry, I'm just talking as I remember
No,
things.
that's fine. Please do.
My
This is
worst
why
day.
we're here.
Yes. Okay. I'm sure you can put some. Yeah. Use the bits that you want to use. So I really admire. I was a real Stanley Tucci fan before the movie. So I'm filming. I'm 45. So I basically watched him in Murder One, as the baddie in Murder One,
Oh,
and
yeah.
then because of that, went to see Big Night, his restaurant movie. So I was quite an early. I mean, certainly in the I like. No, that sounds ridiculous. I was an early Stanley Tucci fan. Other people came late to the party. I just thought he was great. And I felt like I managed to get through my first couple of conversations with Stanley Tucci without sounding like an idiot, or just kind of preserving my dignity, given that I'm wearing Chris's face during these conversations. And I'm so hungry that I basically only talk about cheddar. what I plan to eat. And so there's a scene, I think, so it's not Chris and Stanley Tucci sitting, it's them standing on the ward, and Chris is saying, you've got to give me a chance. Like, come on, Doc, you've got to give me a chance. That scene filmed really late in the day, as I remember it. And so I was trying to time my espressos, my Baroccas, and the 800 calories that I was going to eat correctly throughout the day. And I thought we were filming so much earlier than that. I just didn't ration myself very intelligently. So by the later stage of the day we filmed, I was not all there. I was a bit jittery. And so Chris did the scene, clocked off for the day, and then I went in to do it with Stanley, and I was like, great. The first time I met Stanley Tucci, I didn't seem mad. And then did the scene with him, and there was like one line that I just got a bit, and like I said, my job as I saw it was to be a human costume and to make it possible for this effect to work, however much they did or did not need to use that specific version of the effect. And so I just got the line a little bit wrong. I can't remember what line. And somebody said, okay, that was good. That was a clean take. And Stanley Tucci had to say, no, I'm really sorry. The line was a bit wrong there.
Oh.
And then I was like, no, he's right. He's right. I did get that wrong. And then I did it again and got the line right. And then the scene ended. And I was like, okay, I just need to go away and just be by myself for a while. And I went to the toilets, to the nearest toilets, and stared into the mirror and cried. But
Oh no.
my tears fell down another man's face.
Oh, that's the
Watching,
title of your autobiography.
yeah. I watched myself crying down Chris's face, or at least a sort of nightmarish version of Chris's face covered in green spots. Yeah, I felt
I'm
quite
sure
happy.
you had many other opportunities to work with Mr. Tucci on that movie, and I'm sure all was forgotten and forgiven.
Oh, and he's a gent. He's absolutely delightful.
Joe said that you had to go through multiple takes on the one scene where the two of you are at Camp Lehigh drinking schnapps, and they're trying to
Yes.
do the thing where you pass the hand in front, and that was a pure nightmare for basically. That's what Joe talked about, was how awful that was trying to get that one silly scene to work.
It was really tricky, and it's also most of Chris's height on me is legs. So my torso is not as radically different a size to his as they might like. So I was also aware of being like, I'm actually kind of feeling a bit big to be doing this bit. So as we were trying to work out the schnapps thing, I was like, can I compress my spine down to a more kind of unfit for the military size? I think some of the working out of the schnapps happened before I got there. I remember training camp being a big deal and being really complex. The grenade was pretty early. I remember filming the grenade really early, and that was quite it's a great scene. It's a great bit of writing
It
and
is.
quite
Yeah. Oh,
moving.
yeah. Yeah. But I mean, just from a visual effects point, there's grass moving in the background. There's wind. There's different lighting conditions. It must have been, oh, not now.
Yeah.
We got to wait another couple of hours before the shadows
Yeah.
are right.
Yeah.
So.
Tommy Lee Jones was trash talking the extras quite a lot.
In a good way or a bad way?
He just was saying that they were doing the exercises wrong, I seem to remember, or not fast enough. While these extras who'd been doing star jumps, kind of however many hours, occasionally would get ribbed by Tommy Lee Jones. It was really tricky, and I think that again, this is a long time ago, so your memory can play tricks on you. But I remember the press ups being the first day, and I remember the continuity. So I guess the script supervisor, the woman who was in charge of continuity, the look of horror in her face as she realized how this technical aspect of the film was going to work and what a nightmare it was. For her department, I mean, all got there in the end. And like I say, like you're only like one small cog in a very big machine. But it was, yeah.
Can you say when the bartender role popped up? Where did that come about?
Yeah, I think that was there from the as I remember there from the beginning. I think they wanted it as a kind of Easter egg to have like a little just to kind of. know that he's in a different bit of it. Yeah, I had a curly wig. I'm not quite sure. That was had a nice curly wig and a really outrageously brown tank top. I remember really enjoying the outfit. That was good. I think that was in London. I think that was one of the only bits in London, London pub. Yeah, I think that's
And
right.
that's a typical thing with Joe in the Rocketeer. He had
Yeah.
there's a stunt fellow, Tiny Ron, who did Lothar,
Oh,
and
wow.
he's also in a momentary scene when the Rocketeer is flying through the cornfield, and
Yeah.
he passes by two farmers, and the bigger guy says, "Big gopher." And
Yeah.
that's Tiny Ron out of all the gear, so he didn't get to wear dots that day like you did.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no,
But
I thought it was really nice, like yeah, it's like a cute sort of extra thing for people
I
to have in
imagine it was
films.
gratifying to you to know that your face would show up somewhere in the film.
Yeah, exactly. At some point in that film, the back of my head may or may not be in certain bits of it, and my ribs might be there sometimes or maybe not. But my face actually is in the movie.
So when just to get the sight lines right, did Chris have to wear like your eyeballs on his chest or something to show where they were going to be looking at? I would imagine that somehow they had to tell him, "No, don't look here, look down here."
I think the green dots were so complicated that I just entered a fugue state when people started putting green dots onto me. I would sort of I'd be just turning around and then suddenly I'd be covered in green dots. And I thought, you know what, if I try and think about what the green dots are, I'm going to lose my mind. So yeah, hang on, let me, so they would, they are supposed to be looking at my eye line, the eye line that of my actual physical real body is the correct eye line, but then Chris has to have a mark on his chest. That's got to be right, doesn't it? Yeah, okay.
I would think that would be it. And but it was always it, they always had like you were trying to match Chris's movement, so I would assume that the first take would be Chris, and then you'd come in second so that
Yeah.
they would match that up.
If at all possible, we would try and, so the scene with the bin, Chris did, if at all possible, it's best for Chris to do all his takes and then me copy the ones that they liked, basically. The bin ended up being complicated enough that I was doing his takes as he was talking to Joe about the scene, because the simple takes, like, it's a really important formative scene for Steve Rogers, like, to get to know him. So Chris and Joe were like talking about, you know, what they wanted from it in terms of acting, in terms of drama. And whenever they were done, CGI would come up to people and say, okay, so take five, where he hits his face really hard on the bin. Or you've got to get, can we try and get take seven and eight right now, where he brushes his left shoulder twice, but then he only brushed his pocket once. So I would kind of scurry in and try and get those right while he was going. Yeah.
The script supervisors must have been an entire department, I would imagine, trying to follow everything going on with you and Chris at the same time. It's just.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I can't remember the name of the woman who was the script supervisor, because I did definitely, after every take, look into her eyes and try and judge whether I
See
had
the horror.
whether I'd ruined her life or not.
One of the qualities I like about your partial performance of Steve Rogers is his stillness. And maybe this was just a consequence of the VFX requirements, but I think it would have been easy to portray young Steve Rogers as awkward or gangly and flailing around, but he's not. He's still, he's self-contained. He's kind of like a wary, wiry animal who might spring into action. And was that a character choice? Was that a VFX choice? Did you have any input into that aspect of the character?
I think some of it, I just kind of watched Chris's performance slot into place and saw it make sense for me as it happened. The bit in the car where he says, I got beat up around that corner, he was talking to Peggy Carter. Hayley's an amazing actress, so doing those scenes after Chris did them always felt very, like, intense, like, it felt like, because you kind of, Hayley doesn't half act. So you would get to do the scene with Peggy Carter, and it was amazing. But yeah, the bit where he says, I got beat up around that corner on that street, and says it in this very matter-of-fact way. He's a combination of having like this kind of true North Star of decency, but he's also someone who's quite realistic about life. He's not really, I think it was a kind of a scrappy, when I first read it, I was like, so is he like Scrappy Doo? Like, he just can't learn. that he is too weak for any of this. But the stillness that Chris approached with, I guess, is that he knows, he absolutely knows. He knows when he gets into the fight with the guy in the movie theater that this is, he's not going to win that fight. But he does it anyway.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? I suppose when we think of someone like being a loser or being physically weak, we imagine quite a lot of anxiety in it or like kind of like nervous, jittery energy. That's not really what Chris does with it at all. It's a, he has a quiet calm that knows, I know what the right thing is to do, and I'm definitely too small to do it, but I will do it anyway.
Yeah. I think it's a beautiful summation of the character.
Yeah. You were basically, I mean, the, for lack of a better term, you were the costume for Skinny Steve.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people like Stanley and like Haley, they so really sold it that you were Steve. And just watching all those scenes where you're interacting with them and knowing that, you know, your body is there with Chris Evans' head on it. But I think the combination, every time you were working with these people, you were both selling it, the reality of the thing. And it takes a while. I mean, I remember sitting in the, and I'm sure everybody else watching this, like, how did they do that? It seemed so real, something that it was impossible, but real. And, it's just amazing the power of that acting. I'm assuming that you went to the premiere and things like that. Did you get the red carpet or anything, or how did that go?
No, I didn't. I went, I didn't go to the premiere. I've always been a little bit reticent about imposing myself on a situation that is confusing enough. It is quite confusing enough to work out what is going on there. It's very kind of Haley did an interview about those scenes where she was really, really generous. I feel a big part of it for me was that the three people I mostly work with, Sebastian, Stanley Tucci and Haley Atwell, are three incredibly nice people who were kind of slightly acting around a corner, acting to two different versions of the same thing. And I feel very, warm feelings to all three of them after these years. My relationship with the film is, it's not the first thing I bring up because I'm aware that I sound insane. When I start talking about it, it's been quite good to me. Like, I got quite a lot of TV work in the UK that came, I think, from TV directors going, what the hell does this credit mean? He was skinny. What? I would almost have me in for an audition just to try and figure out what had happened there. So it was good for me in that sense. But I don't do conventions or anything like that. I feel like I did a specific technical job that I'm proud of. And I am still acting after 20 years and still in the game, but I don't really, I slightly shrink from walking around with a t-shirt saying I was the not super bits of Captain America.
The Clark Kent part, yeah.
Would love to talk about some of the rest of your career. I looked you up, of course, and noticed a fair amount of Shakespeare in your resume, although I don't know if it's any more than any young actor would do in England, but you've done The Merchant of Venice, you played Ariel in The Tempest.
Yep.
In 2015, you acted in a TV movie called Richard III, The Princes in the Tower, which is that's my favorite Shakespearean play, Richard III. Is that the kind of material you sought out, or is those just the opportunities that come your way?
Yeah, I've done a mixture. I would say that my career is in terms of my stage stuff, I guess it's like a third Shakespeare, like a quarter. I do quite a lot of slightly French clowny mimey stuff, which you kind of have to see to know what I'm talking about. But UK theatre, obviously, you do end up with a lot of Shakespeare. I think art council funding in this country would be a more difficult sell were it not for the fact that Shakespeare kind of acts as like an umbrella for other arts. The idea of continuing to fund Shakespeare makes a kind of sense across this political spectrum in the UK. So he's always, I think, probably always going to be a big part of our lives. Ariel is my favorite part, I think, or one of my
I'll
favorite
bet. I could
parts.
just imagine you playing that. It seems
Oh, I
like the
love it.
perfect character for kind of a, a spry fella,
Yeah, well, and it was great because it was really lo-fi. They couldn't fly me, so I had to do it all myself. I had bits of blue paint underneath my fingers so that there's this turn that you don't always get in the play where Ariel learns what crying is. It's very like Data from Star Trek. And there's a bit where Data's talking to Prospero and explains seeing somebody crying, doesn't know what it is or what it means. He just describes the water coming from their eyes. And I managed to hide some blue paint on my fingers so I could put them there and kind of drag them down my face as I described it. And walking backwards, a lot of like walking very fast backwards out of scenes, and that kind of the sort of precise physical stuff that I think maybe was the overlap of making some of the Captain America work makes sense. The thing in the UK I'm most often recognized for is Merlin, which is our King Arthur thing. We had a King Arthur thing that Colin Morgan was played Merlin in, and I play a servant in one episode of that. So that's a real nerd's Easter egg to discover that some of Steve Rogers, an unknown percentage of Steve Rogers, is also the character of George from one episode of Merlin.
Wait,
But
isn't that the
I remember seeing
bartender
some,
from? Yeah.
yeah.
I remember seeing some Merlin in the States as well. I think it made it over here.
Yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah,
Well,
wonderful.
I.
And so, what have you done lately, and what are you working on now? Anything you can tell us about? We can look forward to seeing you in.
Yeah, so I've been doing a lot of touring theatre recently. So the last thing I did was in London at the Hampstead. That was a play about two. It was a play about a young mother gets. It was called Apex Predator. A young mother gets turned into a vampire by one of her school teachers. So at the school gates of the primary school, she meets a teacher who is also a vampire, who turns her into a vampire. It's a comedy. I played every man they killed.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
So,
wonderful.
yeah, so I got eviscerated in various hats all night. That was really fun. I'm auditioning for stuff at the moment, as they say. You never know what's around the corner. I count myself very lucky to still be doing it. And Captain America, like, was my break. It didn't turn out very directly, because how direct a path can that even lead to? But it was enough to get me rolling with a career that I'm happy with.
What a strange experience it must be for you to be in this big budget, big special effects, blockbuster cornerstone of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I mean, what a feather in your cap. What an odd thing compared to most of the other stuff you do.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I kept the prosthetic for a long time. The chin, basically, there was like a kind of like rubbery painted chin. My skin, I think the makeup department said my skin is bamboo with an olive adjuster, which is not the same as Chris's. So there's a certain amount of like making those fit. So I kept the chin for ages, but I would always forget. I'm very forgetful and would often put it in a drawer that my wife wasn't expecting to find it in. So she finally said, "I'm so sick of finding this chin in unexpected places." It did kind of rot. I don't know if rot is the right technical
Yeah,
term, but it
no, that stuff
eventually,
disintegrates pretty quick.
it did disintegrate in the end. So I held on to that. I have children now. My son's 11, but when he was first at school and the kids were all into superhero stuff, it was very hard to explain to a child.
My
"That's
dad's
daddy's
Captain
shoulders." Yeah, right.
America.
It's very hard to explain what you're talking about. And there's always a point at which someone might be like, "Oh, so you're saying you're Captain America?" I'm not. No, I'm just trying to explain that I am an unknown percentage of his body in the first half hour of the movie. That's it.
Well, you know what? You are the spirit. You embody the fighting spirit of Captain America.
Oh,
Maybe
thank you.
not the muscles, but the heart. You're the heart.
Oh, it's very kind of you. Thank you.
Oh,
Yeah.
This is exactly why I think we started this podcast, is so that we knew there were so many moving parts in this film, and there's so many fascinating stories. I mean, everybody from the kid that gets thrown in the Albert Docks over in Liverpool to, I mean, the fellow that played Gilmore Hodge, he had such an amazing story in talking about this. Even, oh my gosh, there were, we're now 100 minutes in, so we've talked to so many different people, but just being able to get, I remember, Brian, you remember Marek Arovec, who was the first guy that gets run over by a tank in the first 2 minutes of the movie. But everybody has the same, the common denominator coming out of all this is what a wonderful time in their lives everybody seemed to have in making this film.
And always, but like I said, I've not done much film, really. But the feeling that when you get through all the layers of decision making and you get to the center of the film where the producers are, but most importantly, where the director is, when you finally f see the director in the like tented area or wherever he is looking at it, and he's just really chilled and enthusiastic about the work he does, like it makes a huge difference. Makes a huge difference, actually. Like it all like there was a feeling of optimism that I found everywhere that I went and worked on it. All from the prosthetics department, who were just, in a room making bodies and faces and arms, and which is lovely, lovely chilled people, and the stunt department, who are kind of running around like 10-year-old boys, just going, yeah, I just punched someone with a shield. But yeah, no, like I say, it's a very weird memory, but it is a happy one. Definitely a happy one.
Oh,
lovely.
We've done a couple of Joe Johnston films now, and it just seems like he's the eye of the hurricane. There's so many moving parts, and then right in the middle of all this, it seems like everybody gets the message from Joe: you're in a great movie, and we're gonna make magic together today. And that seems what has come out of all the different people we've talked to.
No, honestly, I am going to rewatch Rocketeer tonight. That is the main thing that this has made me think. Go and
Awesome.
rewatch
You'll
Rocketeer.
enjoy it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, again, thanks for being a part of our show, Leander. Really, really appreciate that very much. I'd like to ask our audience, too, if you'd like to continue this conversation. We're always available over at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like the show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, great big one called capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.